I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Joe Testa. Joe is the tax commissioner for the state of Ohio, a man near and dear to my heart. Joe, let's talk about the tax amnesty program that Ohio has rolled out. It started on May the 1st, continues till June the 15th.
It's a time in which people can become current on their on taxes that they'd either forgotten about or underreported in the past and get by with less of a penalty, less interest and so on. So it's a lower the tax liability in total because the interest and penalties would be reduced.
But what would you say to a very good law-abiding citizen, a taxpayer who has always filed their tax returns on time? And what do you say to them if they suggest, hey, wait a minute, you know, why should somebody who's failed to file their tax return get out of the penalty?
It's, again, the idea is that we get people to come forward of which we're not aware. You're not eligible for tax amnesty if you have already been audited or if you've been assessed. Another way of saying it is that if the state tax department knows about this, then you're not eligible for tax. So the idea is to get the people to come forward with a reduced penalty and interest and become current, less expensive. And then, hopefully, then once they have done that, then they will understand what their responsibilities are. And they will be remain current in the future because, you know, what do we want? We want taxes to be low. We want our taxes to be equitable. But we all have the responsibility to comply with the law. So that's the reason.
And this program covers most all types of taxes in the state, including income tax, sales tax, old corporate franchise tax.
But old personal property, excise taxes.
But the consumer use tax is under a separate program.
Yeah, the legislature decided to carve out consumer use tax as a separate amnesty program, which has been going on since last fall, goes on for another year, actually. So it's a much longer time period. That is separate, but that is still going on now. So you can still obviously participate in consumer use tax amnesty, which is actually more forgiving, if you will. It has a very different structure.
For people who don't know, you're on your Ohio income tax return.
Yes.
There's actually a line. So if you go online and you buy an item, for example, from out of state, and that vendor, whoever sold it to you, is not required to withhold Ohio sales tax, you are responsible. So for all of you listening out there, if you've gone online and not paid Ohio sales tax, you most likely are liable for that sales tax on internet purchases.
Yes, that's right. And that's something that people don't understand. But as you pointed out, it is our obligation to, as individuals, to pay it if it hasn't been collected.
And Commissioner, Ohio, the state, will actually be able to take advantage of this additional revenue, correct?
Yes. We're estimating about $40 million should come in for general tax amnesty. About $4 million of that would be local money. It would go back to the local school districts for school district income tax or to the counties where they have additional sales tax that's collected. So it benefits the local community as well. And again, as it does that without raising any tax rates, it just means we're doing a little bit better job of collection. But people have to come forward.
And if folks want to learn more, they can go to the website, which is
OhioTaxAmnesty.gov.
You've been listening to BusinessWise. I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Joe Testa. Joe is the tax commissioner for the state of Ohio. And Joe, the tax amnesty program is up and rolling. It will continue until June 15th, and on that date, the window closes, and people will no longer be able to come forward on back taxes that they may owe. Why is the state choosing to do this now?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that it is an opportunity for people to come forward at a reduced impact because of waiving of penalties and half of the interest. So it reduces the tax burden, if you will, on the individual to come forward. It helps to bring people in compliance with the tax law. And also, it is additional revenue for the state and for the local jurisdictions as well, because we collect certain taxes for local jurisdictions as well, without raising taxes, without raising tax rate. So it's an idea which states have done. Ohio did it in 2006 last time. And it again, it does help to bring in additional revenue without raising tax rates. It is a real tax break. It's a real liability break for the individual.
As a tax practitioner, I know that the interest and penalties can oftentimes be as much or more than the tax, too. Not everyone's qualified, though.
No, you're not qualified if you have been audited, if you have been assessed, or if you're under audit for the tax. Again, the idea is that we're trying to reach people of which we're not aware, have never not reported or have underreported it that the state would not know about. Once we know about it, then you're not eligible
for
amnesty.
So if people want more information about the tax amnesty program, the website is
OhioTaxAmnesty.gov.
Another big issue that I hear a lot about, and it's getting a lot of attention in Columbus, is the whole discussion about an income tax cut. So yes. Maybe you can share yes. what the issue is around that.
The governor is very interested in reducing income tax rates in Ohio. We are high and we are not competitive in that respect. There have been a lot of tax reform initiatives that have taken place in recent years that are making Ohio more business and individual tax friendly. This is an area mm-hmm. where we have made some progress.
Well, like the estate tax goes away next year.
Certainly. And income tax from tax reform has come down, but we're still not very competitive. So we really like to continue to drive that down. Our top rate is at 5.9%, and that we think that's too high. The way that we're going to try to address this fracking process that you hear about, you know, the oil and gas industry with this new technology, new revenues that are going to be generated from that, what we want to do with it is use it, capture it to drive down the income tax rates in Ohio for all Ohioans.
And I've looked at the graphs, I've looked at the pictures. Our rate would be very low compared to other states.
Very low. We're extremely low now. I mean, we're about the lowest now. I mean, and with the proposal that we have, it would still keep us on the low end. So we want to continue to be mm-hmm. competitive, obviously. We don't want to, you know, raise it to it's too high to be a real deterrent to business. But at the same time, be able to capture that, because this is a natural resource for Ohio. And, the governor's perspective is that ought to benefit all Ohioans. Mm-hmm. And this is the way we've come up with to do it.
To me, again, the reason I love this proposal is because small businesses in the state of Ohio effectively pay tax on all their business income
yes.
at their individual rate.
Yes.
Whereas very large corporations, for example, pay not one dime of income tax
right.
in the state of Ohio.
Right.
So anytime you can reduce the tax rates for individuals and small business, it's a great opportunity.
Absolutely. And so we're real hopeful that we'll be able to get that into the legislature and through.
And if people would like more information about the income tax cut, they can actually go to the website at the state. It's governor.ohio.gov. Look under Transforming Ohio for Growth and then the income tax cut. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Todd Swarmstead. Todd is the founder and the executive director of the American Sign Museum. And the American Sign Museum is this very well-kept secret. It's just a treasure that we have in our community that so many people don't know about. But you have grown now to the point where you're going to be celebrating next week your grand opening of a new facility.
Pretty much we are a best-kept secret in Cincinnati. We are probably better known outside of Cincinnati. This is the only public sign museum in the country, and I'm pretty sure in the world because I used to travel one time internationally. I worked on a magazine about signs for 28 years. And being a collector, I'd been around to sign shops across the country. They were always throwing out not only signs, but materials and equipment, sketches, etc. And I thought that there ought to be a place to house all this to actually reconstruct the history of the sign industry. I view the history of signs as a kind of a micro history of the history of America. And I can break that out into probably at least three subcategories. It's a history of design trends in the U.S. I could take you on a tour through the museum tracking design trends, Art Deco, Art Nouveau, the funky 50s, whatever. It's also a history of technology. With the advent of the light bulb and electricity turn of the century, the advent of light bulb signs. With the advent of plastic in the post-war, the advent of plastic signs. So it's a history of technology in the U.S. as well. Thirdly, it's a history of, I guess you would call it, marketing, advertising, etc.
The museum does have a new home. There's a sneak preview of the grand opening, which won't be to the public, correct, until the 23rd of June?
On Saturday, June 2nd, we're having a sneak preview that's open to the public.
Okay.
From 1 to 5 p.m. This is kind of a fundraiser for us. The first 200 who actually register will receive a special commemorative T-shirt. 3 weeks later is actually the formal grand opening with a ribbon cutting.
But if people would like to get a sneak preview to come to the fundraiser, it is this coming Saturday. And the time is?
1 to 5 p.m.
Where is the new museum?
The new museum is in the Camp Washington area of Cincinnati, which is not always well known by everybody, but it's the Hopple Street exit of I-75. It's located actually at 1330 Monmouth. We will not exactly be doing tours for the sneak preview, We will begin doing tours on the 23rd. I think it's going to be a celebration and not fit for actual tours, but I will certainly be there telling stories about some of the signs.
But can people walk around the museum and take a look at all the signs?
Everything will be on display. I'm not going to say that we're going to be 100% done, but there is plenty to see. We've already been having people come already from out of town and saying, I just got a seat, I'm only here for a day. So we invite them to come in.
And if people want to learn more about the Sign Museum and about the sneak preview that's occurring this Saturday on June the 2nd, how can they get that information?
We actually have a website, www.signmuseum.org. And all the information about the grand opening and the sneak preview on Saturday, June 2nd, is there.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Today, our guest is Todd Swermstedt. Todd is the founder and executive director of the American Sign Museum. And Todd, I know that your family has been in the sign business, really the sign publishing business, for over 100 years, but you branched off a few years ago and started a separate organization, the American Sign Museum, that collects and displays signs. Maybe you can tell us how many different types of objects you've cataloged over these years.
The magazine, the flagship magazine of ST Media Group International, is Signs of the Times.
And ST Media is your family's business.
ST Media is a family business. It's actually a communications company. It has trade magazines, websites, trade shows, conferences, all surrounding the design and graphics industry.
And a few years ago, you had this passion, this vision, really, to create a not-for-profit organization that captured, historically, signs for others to share.
I began working in a magazine right out of college about 1975. Started in a lowly position of editorial assistant. I was asked which magazine I wanted to work on, and Signs of the Times was kind of my passion because I appreciated the craftsmanship behind signage. And worked on that magazine for, I'm thinking, 27, 28 years, and got the idea one night to start a sign museum because there wasn't one anywhere in the country. Called up some mentors of mine, mostly in the sign industry, but these are people that I respected their opinions. And I got a very strong go for it and didn't really know how to do museums per se. Spent some time on the internet looking at museum sites and basically just jumped in. So January 99, I quit working on the magazine and just launched into the museum. We incorporated in March of 1999. We got our not-for-profit status the next year in January. The museum certainly has signs. It's a sign museum, but we have about 4,000 cataloged items. Of the 4,000 cataloged items, only about 550 are signs. We have a library of about 800 books and catalogs. We've got a photo archive of 1,200 images. We have tools and equipment, sketches, salesman samples, so anything related to sign making.
And the new museum, which you're having your grand opening party, your sneak preview party, this coming Saturday, will there be a place there for students, for people who want to have parties, events?
We view the museum as a great reference. I already mentioned the photo archives and the library, but it's also a great place for events. Now, by events, I mean receptions, parties. You don't have to put up any decorations, as those who come on Saturday will see. But it's also, we have two screens and projector system for business meetings, for seminars. We are hoping to attract a lot more of the local student population as well.
So Todd, again, the new location for the new home for the Sign Museum is over in the Camp Washington area. If people would like information, they could go to your website.
www.signmuseum.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. This is graduation season, Tom, and many students are coming out of college. They got a four-year degree in their hand, maybe even a graduate degree in their hand. But now they've started their first job, hopefully, but they don't know what to do next. They don't know how to save their money. They don't know whether to invest in retirement plans where they work.
Well, first of all, congratulations to all of them who do have jobs because they're very difficult to get these days. If you do get a job, don't rush out and celebrate too much with that first paycheck. Think about your long-term, think about your budget, think about the expenses you're going to have. Unfortunately, as you enter the workforce, sometimes your expenses go up and you have more rent. You may have more clothes you have to buy for work.
You know, this sounds very basic and fundamental, but unfortunately, most people don't do it or they don't know how to do it properly. Put a budget together and just think of a budget as like an outline. Outline where you're taking a class. Just think of your finances like that. Consider how much money after tax that you're going to be receiving every month, because if you're getting a job that pays you $50,000 a year, it's going to be a lot less once all the taxes are taken out. So determine what your net paycheck is going to be every month. Then you have to figure up just what you were talking about, Tom. All of the expenses, gas, college loan payments, potentially if you've had some college debt, clothes, dry cleaning, food, if you have your own apartment, rent.
And entertainment. And what I found, not just with college students, but with people of all ages, is most people, when they develop a budget, they way underestimate their what I'll call discretionary expenses. They know what their fixed costs are. They know what their rent, their car payment, their debt payments are, but they don't realize how much money they spend just day to day.
When you first start your job, if you have the opportunity to participate in your company's 401k or other retirement plan, have that money taken from your paycheck. Don't even let it appear in your net check. Have it directly deposited into your retirement account at work so that you start saving early. You will never be able to recapture the magical compounding impact that saving at an early age has. So that really should be your very first duty to yourself, is to put money in your retirement account.
The next duty you should have is try to develop an emergency fund. You know, now that you're out of college, the emergency fund no longer is mom and dad for most people, or it shouldn't be. Financial planners recommend that you have 3 to 6 months of living expenses saved up in a cash type fund. Now, you can't do that in 1 year typically, but you need to start saving towards that goal.
As controversy as this may sound, consider opening up a credit card if you don't have one yet, because a credit card clearly will help you establish good credit. You will need credit when you want to buy a house, when you want to get a loan. So it's important to have good credit, but you have to have the discipline to pay that credit card off every month. And credit cards are not all created equal. Find one that provides perks, maybe money back guarantees or discounts on air travel, things that can help you in a financial way as well.
Well, and use the credit card as a convenience, still maintaining your budget. Don't use it as a means of purchasing something that you couldn't otherwise afford.
And before you go out and make that big purchase on impulse, go home, think about it for a day or two. And if you really still want it at that point, then consider buying it. Try to avoid impulse purchases, because that is one very easy way to get trapped in a huge amount of financial debt. For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Tom, we recently received a question from an individual who had been at a spring fundraiser for their school, and they bought something at a silent auction. And the question was, can they deduct that? And it actually, they ended up buying a trip.
And they may be able to deduct a portion of it. The rule is, if you pay more than fair market value, then the excess amount would qualify as a deduction.
So, for example, if you paid $1,500 for a 3-day getaway, but the fair market value of that was $1,000, then you may be entitled to a charitable contribution deduction of $500, the difference.
But what you need is a letter from the charity telling you that you made a charitable deduction so you can document your deduction.
And it's also important to remember that you can only deduct contributions if you itemize your deductions. So if your cumulative itemized deductions are greater than your standard deductions, you cannot take a tax deduction for a charitable contribution if you do not itemize on Schedule A.
Yeah, the other side of the coin, oftentimes a question I get is, I contributed a trip. I have a timeshare or a vacation home, and I contributed a week of that to my school or my favorite charity for their auction. What's the deduction I can take?
Well, and that's a little trickier, isn't it? So it's generally the lower of your cost or the value of the timeshare, for example. Let's say you've contributed a timeshare. So the cost of the timeshare, which many people define as the annual fee that you spend to maintain the timeshare, or is cost of that week less? So if a week at a vacation at your timeshare is less than the annual cost to keep it, then you're most likely going to be limited to the value.
But if it's a rental property, you know, if you have a vacation home that you use as a rental property, then really you don't have a deduction because you're not paying tax on the income that you would have gotten if you had rented it. So it's a net zero from a tax standpoint.
We get the question similar to that. We get the question, well, I donated an hour of my time. You can't take a deduction for time spent. That's not deductible. Now, any out-of-pockets you incur to help a charity or contribute to your not-for-profit activity are deductible. But your time, unfortunately, is not eligible for a tax deduction.
Well, another question people get is, should I donate stock? Is that a good deal for me? And, well, it may be. If you're going to make a donation otherwise, donating appreciated stock that you've held for more than a year allows you to take a deduction for the fair market value of that stock.
Now, you use the word appreciated because that's very important. Because if you want to give away stock that's declined in value, lower than your cost, then you want to sell the stock, take the loss, and then contribute the cash, because you cannot take a deduction for loss in value of stock that you contribute to a charity.
That's right. And also, if you've held stock for less than a year, no matter what the value is, you can only deduct the cost basis. You can't deduct the value if it's higher.
You can go to the IRS's website at irs.gov and check out the qualified charities. And certainly feel free to email us if you do have any questions. You can reach us at info@cfscpa.com. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Jim Cunningham. Jim is the executive director of CCAP, which is Cincinnati's angel capital hub. And Jim, you work very closely with the Queen City Angels. Let's talk about, first of all, what is an angel and what are the Queen City Angels?
Well, angels are successful business people, by and large, who invest in startup companies. They're usually the first strangers to invest in a company after friends and family. And they're, I think of them as the farm team to the venture capital industry. So they'll do deals that are too raw for venture capitalists. They'll put in smaller amounts of money. And then because of their experience, they nurture these companies along until they're either successful or they need venture capital money.
Just because you have money doesn't mean that you're going to automatically be successful. So the Queen City Angels provide some mentoring and leadership as well, don't they?
Yes, that's a big part of it. In fact, we call what we do mentor capital. One great thing about the Midwest is people are willing to help. And especially if you get some of their money, their hearts and minds will follow. So our guys sit on the boards of companies. We act as advisory boards. We're fortunate we've got a lot of technology people. Probably a majority of the people have technology degrees and then got MBAs and ran their own companies. So we've got the ability to help an online startup or a biotech startup because our people have been in those fields. And that's been very valuable, both for the companies and therefore for our financial success.
Well, and I know that you do many things that are valuable, Jim, through your work with CCAP. But one of those valuable resources that you provide to the community is a boot camp that's coming up in the first part of June. Maybe you can talk about that.
It's June 6th and 7th, Crystal. Entrepreneurs need a lot more than money, and they often need preparation to get them ready to really seek money. It's a two-day program, and we bring in a lot of our investors to speak. We also bring in a lot of professionals, successful entrepreneurs, and for a day and a half, they talk about marketing, sales, business plan, preparation, and so forth. It's really for people everywhere from somebody who's has an idea and is trying to decide whether to quit their day job and start a company, up to somebody that has a successful small business but has not raised outside capital before. So because we're investors and because it's very hard for an entrepreneur to understand how investors think, we spend a fair amount of time talking about startups from the investor's point of view and preparing these people to really present their business so that third parties like investors can understand it. We're very fortunate because our guys and our women members,
guys and gals,
are successful people. They know a lot of successful people. They've worked with CPAs and lawyers and other business people, and they've drawn all them in to help these startups.
If folks would like to learn more about CCAP, about the boot camp, what's your website?
It's www.thecircuit.com. CUNYFaulkner.net, and they can find the boot camp right on the front page.
I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with CUNY Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Jim Cunningham. Jim is the executive director of CCAP, which is Cincinnati's angel capital hub. And I think you guys do a great job in terms of so many different resources that you provide to the startup entrepreneurial community here in our region. And one of those events that you're having for entrepreneurs is the boot camp, June 6th and 7th. Where is it going to be at?
It's at the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati. They graciously let us use their facilities right at the Rookwood Pavilion.
You know, we've talked about on many occasions the beauty of mentoring and how mentoring small businesses, when you can combine the expertise of small and larger minds and people with different outlooks, the value. And you do have a mentoring piece that comes along with the boot camp.
You know, this is something that we really innovated. I hadn't seen at any other boot camps, but because our strength is our network with all these investors and their friends and professionals, the boot camp is 2 days. And for a day and a half, we have panels and speakers. But the second afternoon, every entrepreneur gets to meet individually with an investor and a local professional and discuss his or her business plan for an hour. And that, we have found, is one of the big draws of the boot camp, because so many people just aren't connected to high-level professionals and investors. To feel like it's part of our mission is to bring people into the network. So we have all local speakers, and we have these breakout sessions because it's important for people not only to learn what they need to know, but meet the people whom they need to know. The point of the boot camp is two things. One, to learn how to build a successful business, and clearly that's number one. But along with that, to learn how to present their business to third parties, whether it's investors or customers or the like, so that they can not only understand the business themselves, but they can communicate it. And so we focus a lot on the viewpoints of professionals and third parties so that you can reach out. Because in a lot of ways, an investor is another type of customer. So if you can learn to sell to investors and to product customers, that's a big plus for startups. One company called Spineform, where the whole team came to the boot camp probably 6 or 7 years ago. They have a device that is a much less invasive way to help scoliosis, particularly in teenage girls, where it can be a serious disabling impediment. And then probably our best known graduate is Candace Klein, who's founded Bad Girl Ventures and now the crowdfunding company called SomoLend, and she's now chair of the national committee that's working with Congress on the new crowdfunding online funding rule. You know, I've never talked to an entrepreneur, Crystal, who said, I did it on my own. Every one of them builds a network of mentors, talks to all the smart people they can talk to, learns how to reach out. And I think that's a strength of our area, is that people will help for free.
If folks would like information about the circuit, about the boot camp, where can they find that?
Our website is www.thecircuit.net.
Thank you for listening to Business Wise. I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with CUNY Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom CUNY.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Today, our guests are Dr. Ed Hughes, who's the president and CEO of Gateway Community and Technical College, and Dr. Patricia Goodman, who's the vice president of knowledge management and strategic initiatives for Gateway. Gateway is both a community and technical college. Part of your mission, I think, is to educate people so that after their 2 years at your school, they're job ready. Is that how you view your mission?
Yeah, we actually view it three different ways. Certainly, job ready is one. Prepared and skilled to go on to post-secondary beyond associate degree like the university. And working with our community to get more people college ready. So we're the meat between the two pieces of bread, if you will. We have to be about creating students ready to take jobs that are available. And we do that through partnerships with business and industry. If we're doing our job, our bottom line is their bottom line. If we can increase their productivity through our graduates, then that's what we need to be doing. And one of the things that Dr. Goodman's office does in knowledge management is take data and turn it into information that we can use to help us understand better what those needs are in the community.
On that point, I can imagine that it not only gives Gateway a very big competitive advantage, but also our region as a whole gains.
Absolutely, and it really speaks to the accountability of the college, to the business community.
Dr. Hughes, I guess to that point, is this something that you think all universities and community colleges across the country are doing, or do you think we just seem to be a little more focused and targeted in our strategic initiative here in this region?
Well, we have a pendulum that goes on in education like anything else. You go from the liberal arts of the 60s that was a free menu and do all kinds of things to a much more structured approach that we're at today. But I do think the good community and technical colleges and universities focus on this, and they find ways to collaborate across the sectors so that a community is actually served. We're both a reflection and a leading edge of what that community ought to be.
Do you see yourselves as serving both the businesses who are utilizing your graduates ultimately and the students who otherwise may not be educated in the same fashion that you're able to do?
Oh, I think you've hit a really key point. We have to do both of those. Again, you're listening to the customer, and the customer in this case is the business as well as the student. And those who say, oh, well, students come because they don't know what they want, they know exactly most of the time what they want, and our job is to try to help moderate that and facilitate that, as well as get them prepared to do what the community needs.
Gateway, under your leadership, and along with Northern Kentucky University under Dr. Vertruba's leadership, has really grown and fueled this economic engine here in our region over the last 10 years. Do you see that moving forward with the new president, and have you had a chance to meet him yet?
I have not had a chance to meet your new president. We're part of a network of community colleges. I've talked to the community colleges in Cleveland. They speak very highly of him and his view about community colleges, and I'm looking forward. I think our whole college is looking forward because we've had nothing but an outstanding advocate for Gateway Community College. There's not been anybody bigger than Jim Vertruba. That's very unusual for a new community college to emerge literally in the shadows of a great urban university like this that's also emerging, and we get the support from the university to help us rather than hinder us from growing. That's not happened here. Jim has been a terrific partner with us.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Dr. George Riedeveld. Dr. Riedeveld is a professor of economics at the University of Cincinnati and also the director of research for the Economics Center for Education and Research at UC. You know, one of the things I'd like to talk about is Europe, and specifically Greece and Spain and their economic problems. How did they get there, and why is it going to affect the United States so much?
To understand how they got there, I think we have to take a look at the European Union, the decisions they made about a common currency in the Eurozone. You know, for a long time, there have been European countries who haven't behaved themselves very well as far as their fiscal policy, running big deficits and accumulating debt. That happened before the common currency. That happened before the so-called Eurozone. And what we found is after the Eurozone, their behavior really hasn't changed at all. But the conditions under which they've made those decisions have changed. Everybody likes to talk about Greece. Let's take a look at Greece for a minute. Greece tend to run big deficits before Eurozone, and the government would go out and borrow money. And of course, to borrow money, they'd float bonds, and they'd accumulate pretty good debt. One of the easy ways to pay down debt is to depreciate your currency. And at that time, of course, Greece's currency was the drachma. So the government or the central bank would print more drachmas. Value of the drachma would fall. It'd make it easier for the government to meet their debt obligations because they're doing it with less valuable drachmas. Well, after a while, lenders catch on to this and they say, hey, wait a minute, the value of your currency is going to fall, so we're going to charge a little higher interest rate. And you see that kind of market forces putting some pressure on Greece not to borrow so much money. So now comes the Eurozone, and Greece no longer has a drachma, it has a euro, and it's a common currency. And you know what?
They can borrow
as much money as they want, and it's not going to cause the euro to lose its value. And so people are going to loan Greece more monies because they're not worried about the value of that currency, now the euro falling. And of course, it's all starting to catch up to Greece right now, where their debts are truly unmanageable. I see no way that in the near future, in the next decade, that grease can pay off this huge debt.
So how do you fix this?
It's a very, very difficult thing to fix. First of all, Europe has to change the conditions of member states joining the common currency. For Greece, that's a little bit too late, but they may have to leave the Eurozone. And in fact, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they did leave the Eurozone. They went back to their drachma. They can print more drachma and handle their debt much better if they can do it with cheap drachma.
Well, and if they devalue their own currency, that also reduces all their pension obligations, doesn't it?
That's correct.
Just the bonds. That's really a big part of their problem, isn't it? All the social promises they've made in terms of financial pensions.
I think that a whole lot of promises have been made. It's a huge part of the problems that Greece face. And I think the Greek people are starting to realize that these promises made by politicians, made by their own government, are totally unreasonable.
So why does this sound familiar to me? Are we on the same path?
We have some of the same issues as far as Medicaid as a very good example, or Social Security. We've got the issues of increasing debt. However, in the United States, we have a common fiscal policy that doesn't encourage us to misbehave even more than what we might. In Europe, we had a common currency, but we didn't have common fiscal policy, and it gave incentives for these member states to behave even more badly than they might with a common fiscal policy.
Thank you so much for being our guest.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to Business Wise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.